how do people view change? Some people hate it. And I don't just mean normal, whatever normal is, just, you know, run-of-the-mill hatred. I mean, we can call these people the habitual. They are steady, methodical people who love routine. Like, you can set your watch by their lifestyle. Change is viewed, got some amens there, change is viewed as the enemy that threatens the stability that comes through normality. Like, don't change anything and there will be stability and therefore the world is right. Like, a perfect day is just like yesterday. Boxes are checked, inbox is empty. Predictable plus controllable equals successful. And change actually, to many, can feel wrong, like something's broken, the habitual. However, some do not hate it, they love it. And we're going to call these the hobos, the drifters, the nomads, the gypsies. The hobo is always ready to pull up tent stakes, move on, redecorate, relocate, another job, another relationship, another church. Change is like a Band-Aid that makes the owie go away. And routine feels claustrophobic to the hobo. We got some hobos in here, huh? It takes everything just to come week after week. Like, that is just painful. Some hate it, some love it. Most have more of a love-hate relationship with change. We'll call these the hesitant, the habitual, the hobos, and the hesitant. Ross has mentioned to our staff many times the studies that reveal that 80% of people do not like change. They often resist it at first. They usually want more information, but they usually will come around. In the book Change or Die, Alan Deutschman, a writer and professor, refers to a private conference at Rockefeller University where a bunch of medical professionals, the big dogs in the medical world, gathered together and talked about the healthcare situation. This is a while ago, and they came to the, well, really announced that the vast majority of healthcare monies were being spent on medical issues related to behavior, behaviorally related medical issues. And Dr. Ray Levy, founder of the Global Medical Forum, told an audience, a relatively small percentage of the population consumes the vast majority of the healthcare budget for diseases that are very well known and, by and large, behavioral. He went on to say, about 80% of the healthcare budget is spent on issues related to five behavioral conditions: too much smoking, too much drinking, too much eating, too much stress, not enough exercise. So what is most remarkable is that when people experience severe medical issues related to these activities, like whether it's lung cancer or clogged arteries or whatever, and medical professionals confront them and say, listen, if you don't change the way you're living, you're going to die really soon. These medical professionals said, one out of 10 will change. Like 90% when confronted with behaviorally related medical conditions, 9 out of 10 will, they may change short term, but they will long term, they will go back to the way what they were doing before, even though they know it will kill them. That's bad news. So Alan Deutschman, though, the writer of this book, Change or Die, said he wasn't satisfied with that. Like, he kept exploring. And I know this is more related not to changes around you, but changes within you. We're going to look at both. But and he began to examine, healthcare programs that help people. They don't just say, listen, you change or die, but they come along and provide services to help them change. And also in the prison rehabilitation programs and things like that. And he began to see very different statistics. And he came to the conclusion, which is the point of this book, that if people are given three things, they actually, the change numbers actually change dramatically. And his conclusion was new hope, a different way of thinking, and new habits or skills. Now, for Christians, that's not surprising at all, right? Like, that's the whole point of the Bible. Like, you're not going to change if somebody just points his finger in your face and say, change or die. Like, there's going to need to be something new within you, like this new hope, Christians would say, a new heart, new mind, new way of thinking, and practical help to create new habits. It doesn't matter if you want to change. That's useless if you don't create new habits or lifestyle of change. So whether you hate change or love change or love-hate change, you know, have a love-hate relationship with change, but will eventually embrace it, you can change the way you think about change. And that's what we want to talk about today. So why are we talking about this now? I would say as a church, it's important to talk about this for a couple reasons. One is we just celebrated our 25th anniversary as a church a few months ago. As we look back on what God has done, we are just stunned by his grace and mercy in our lives as a church. But as we look forward, our goal is not to freeze the past and replicate it in the future. It's not to say, if we could just do what we've done in the past, God's going to continue to do good things here. Maybe. Maybe not. So our goal is not to be addicted to change or fearful of it. How do you get that? Also, in a couple of weeks, we're beginning the Northwest Campus. Around 170 people who we get to see each Sunday. We will not see each Sunday. And that's really hard for some of us to face. So how should we think about these things, about change? Psalm 90, and I know we're going to give an overview, but Psalm 90 provides a beautiful foundation, a life-changing foundation for change. A firm foundation for viewing and doing change. It's a song of, do you see who wrote it there at the top? Moses. That to me is one of the things that makes this so amazing. I know the Spirit inspired Moses, but think about him as a man. His life was threatened as a newborn. He was given up by his parents, adopted, rescued by the royal family in Egypt. So he was raised in Egypt. So he dealt with all those separation, anxiety, like adoption struggles, like who really am I? Where do I fit in? As a young man, he had to flee Egypt for his life. He was a refugee. He was a nomad. As he grew older, God called him to lead the children of Israel, went through a massive leadership revolution where, remember, his style of leadership was very hands-on, micromanagement, and God had to strip him of all of that. And then if you fast forward to the end of his life, he's the thing he's been waiting for his entire life, to lead the people of God into the promised land. And God says, uh-uh. Like, you're not going to go in with them. So here's a guy who, time after time, faced massive changes. Completely a great upheaval. And he's writing about change. Three big points. Number one, God is the unchanging one. God is the unchanging one. Look at Psalm 90, verses 1 and 2. Lord, You have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Moses is saying, look around you. Everything you can see will change. People will come and go. Celebrities will rise and fall. Buildings will rise and then disappear. Presidents will lead and leave. But God is the only one who has preceded everything that is visible and has been from everlasting to everlasting. Look at the way the Bible describes God's eternality. Psalm 102, 25, of old you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you will remain. They will wear out, all wear out, like a garment. You will change them like a robe, and they will pass away. But you are the same, and your years have no end. Isaiah 48, the grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. Malachi 3:6, for I, the Lord, do not change. Therefore you, O children of Israel, are not consumed. That's our hope. Hebrews 13:8, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. Now, these passages are not denying that God interacts with his creation in real, in-time, personal ways, but they are describing his essence, his character, as immutable, unchangeable. So if you are looking for a stable, unchanging, permanent home, and you're looking for that in Greenville, South Carolina, you live in a terrible place. Because there is not one home in Greenville, no matter whether it's a mobile home or a brick home, that is a permanent home. That's what Moses is saying. Only God provides a permanent dwelling place. There was never a time where he was not, and there will never be a time where he is not. Augustine, back in the 400s, wrote to try to encourage the people of God who were fearing change. He lived in the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was under siege, and many feared that civilization would end. He spent 13 years writing The City of God, and he pleaded with Christians not to try to find their security in anything transitory. He wrote this: if you have a house of your own, you are poor. If you have the house of God, you are rich. In your own house, you will fear thieves. In God's house, God himself is the wall. Blessed then are those who dwell in your house. Jack Miller quoted Augustine in a letter he wrote from Kenya. Now understand, Jack Miller had just undergone cancer. He had lymphoma. He was in Kenya, and he was experiencing intense chest pains. He had heart issues, and he feared that he may have had a heart attack. He was also leading a mission team. One of the teams that he was leading had just been attacked by terrorists, and several women had been brutalized. So imagine all of this happening at the same time. Your health is failing. Your team is under attack. The world, just like we just read in Psalm 46, seems to be moving beneath you. And he wrote to a friend who likewise was battling a life-threatening disease. And he quoted Augustine referred to Psalm 84 and then summarized this. If you have made your home this world and whatever you can possess in it, you are always in danger of being plunged into insecurities, fears, and losses. But make God your dwelling place, and you have unlosable treasure and a deeper kind of happiness. Now, this Christmas, my wife turned that into a bookmark. Just was reminding us of this. And it was interesting because we were trying to fix some things that had broken in our home, repaint some things. And the more you do that, what happens? The more you see things that need to be fixed and that are broken and that need to be painted. And it's like, God, like if this is our home, it is an endless cycle. Now, we're not saying you shouldn't take care of your things, don't change the oil in your car, don't paint your house. That's not what God is saying. But that is not your home. Like, that is not your dwelling place. You need to live somewhere now. You need to wear something now. You need to drive something now, perhaps. But that's not your dwelling place. Because if it is, then we're going to constantly fear change. Constantly live in insecurity. God is the unchanging one. That is the foundation for most. It's the foundation for us. Number two, we are the changing ones. God is the unchanging one. We are the changing ones. Look at He says in verse 3, you return man to dust. Do you see that? That's all about change. And say, return, O children of man. So here in this section, he is highlighting two major aspects. First of all, our brevity. Our brevity. It's what he's saying in verse 3 and 4, for 1,000 years in your sight are but as a yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. You sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed, and in the evening it fades and withers. Our brevity. He is saying we go from dust to dust. We are in a cycle of dust. We are dust balls with clothes on. We're like the grass in a hot Palestinian desert, fresh in the morning, fading by night. Our brevity. Second thing he highlights is our depravity. Look at verse 7. For we are brought to an end by your anger, by your wrath we are dismayed. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? So teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. So this passage is describing our fallen condition. It is one of wickedness. Notice he emphasized iniquity. It's also one of weakness, toil, trouble. But the big point he is making, as you'll see in verse 12, is that when we are facing this sense that we all have, unless we're delusional, our brevity and our depravity, and we can even, when that falls on us with new medical news or changes in our lives, when that comes upon us, we can either run to anxiety or run to the delusion of longevity. Like one is just fearing change. The other is convincing ourselves that it's not going to happen. Like as Americans, I'm going to try to live forever here if I just take enough vitamins and eat some kale. Like, I'm going to live forever here. And Moses saying, no, like, I wouldn't recommend that. Like, he was probably pro-kale, but if you're using that as a means of escaping reality, it's not going to work. When we face our brevity and our depravity, he is saying, don't pursue anxiety or longevity, pursue sanity. A heart of wisdom. Wisdom is the mental health of the scripture. It is seeing life from God's perspective. Doing life as intended by God. And so God is calling us away from the insanity of thinking we can either never change or must always change. God is honest with us and tells us like it is. Hey, dude, your life is brief. Your heart is broken. And if you won't face this, you will never change. You might move on. The hobo does the same thing in different places. And the habitual is constantly trying to convince herself or himself that life is controllable. God is the unchanging one. We are the changing one. So where does this real change come from? Like, how do we get this heart of wisdom to see and do life as God intended, to see life as it really is? Third big point. We experience and embrace real change in Him. This final section begins, notice in verse 13, with the word return. And if you may want to, I circled that because if you jump up to verse 3, you'll notice, you return man to dust. So in verse 3, it is the unchanging one is really releasing the changing ones to this dust cycle. But in verse 13, he's talking to God. Like, oh Lord, you return. And it's almost as if he's inviting God into this cycle of dust. So I see glimpses of the incarnation. What's the incarnation? Jesus coming as a man. Like, he became dust. So that's not the end of the story. Like, he's calling God to return. He's calling the unchanging one to change, to enter into our plight, to show pity on us. And when this happens, three things happen for us. Number one, we go to the source of real joy. Verse 14, satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us and for as many years as we have seen evil. So joy is not going to come from keeping things the same or from keeping things different, but from waking up every morning to His steadfast love. And this word morning is significant, but once again, if you look at the word satisfy us in the morning, hey, there was another morning talked about. If you look back at verse 6, you see what we could call a fake morning. Like every morning when the sun comes up, it's like a false alarm. A new day. Well, verse 6 tells us, yeah, but by the end of the day, you're going to be fading. You're like the grass. Like, wow, new day, new hope, new house, new car, new job, new relationship. Woohoo! No, that's going to fade too. Sorry. So if we stop in verse 6, we're in this cycle of, which gets really old. But but this is a different kind of mourning in verse 14. This is the real thing that makes the picture of the real thing, verse 6, come alive because it's grounded in reality. Like busy days full of boring and overwhelming things cannot change his steadfast love, which is new every morning. Lamentations 3, the steadfast love of the Lord never what? Never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. This is a kind of mourning that does not fade. Like, our perception, our feeling of it at times will come and go, but what he's saying is when you're locked in, when your hope is locked into the morning by morning steadfast love of Jesus, and God demonstrated that by entering into our dust-to-dust world, paying for the sin that brings about death. He paid for it all on the cross. And every morning we get to wake up to a fresh glimpse of his steadfast love. So Moses is saying, hey, satisfy my heart in the morning. Satisfy us in the morning. I tend to look to everything else to satisfy me. And that's not going to stay with me. That's not going to last. Satisfy us in the morning. Redecorating or relocating will never satisfy the heart. Maintaining or stabilizing your life will never in and of itself satisfy the heart. God sent his son to live a short life so that nothing can separate you from his long love. God sent his son to live a short life, to die young, so that nothing can ever separate the one who puts his hope in God, in Jesus, from his long love, his steadfast love. Because we can't keep covenant. He always keeps covenant, and he paid for it on the cross. So the first thing is we go to him for this kind of morning by morning joy. Secondly, we see change from God's perspective. We really see all of life, including change, from God's perspective. Look at verse 16. Let your work, your activity be shown to your servants, and your glorious power, your splendor to your children. Moses is asking for help. He knows in the midst of the wilderness, in the midst of the lonely nights, in the midst of the massive changes, we can miss what God is doing. We can lose sight. God, are you doing anything? And he's saying, help me see. Because if we don't see what God is doing, we will villainize or idolize change. We will villainize change, we will hate it, or we will be addicted to it. I was thinking about this Christmas because my wife and daughter busted out the old family videos. So we're watching a lot of these, and nothing makes you feel older faster. Because you're like, whoa, like that was yesterday that I was doing that with my kids. And if your kids are at a stage where, you know, they're all flying the nest, you're just like, what just happened? What just happened? Your heart can actually go to really bad places. But what Moses is saying is listen. Look at life from God's perspective. God is doing some amazing things. Like, what is the goal here? Is the goal to keep everything the same? Don't say amen, some of you people who hate change. Like, is that the goal? To have three-year-olds for eternity. We have a counseling department for those who said yes to that question. Like, that's not the goal, even as precious as those memories are. The goal is to join God in spreading the glory of his fame to all nations. And so when our kids grow up, it's not a failure. It's a success. Like, release them. But if our hearts are finding satisfaction in our identity as a parent or identity or relationship addiction to our kid, like, then we're never going to have stability or security. So we find our joy in him, but then we begin to, because of that, we can look at things from his perspective and see what he's doing. And I've had to go here with this whole Northwest. Like, this has been hard for me to look around and see the faces of people, many of whom have worshiped here for a decade or more. Many. And you say, well, it's only a few minutes on Sunday that you get to actually talk with. But I can't tell you the encouragement of people who, week after week, are ministering to one another, devouring his word, worshiping Jesus, and the thought of saying, well, like, I don't get to do that with them. So if it's all about me and what I enjoy, I will hate that change. It will threaten me. But if I begin to do what verse 16 is describing, Lord, let me see what you're up to. Let me see your glorious power. And I want that to extend to my kids. Like, I want to see your name spread in other places through new people, because obviously as people go, we're going to pray that people come and come to know Jesus and are equipped for service, because there are right now, there are a lot of empty spaces of service where people who have been serving are going to go serve over there. And if people here don't say, hey, I want to help, then we have huge gaps. So if I begin to see things from God's perspective, change changes. Or I change the way I think about it, because I desire to see what he is doing. And the result of that will be a lot of people who are not sulking, but serving. And that's the final thing he says. Look at verse 17. We invest our lives in what matters. We invest our lives in what matters. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. This seems to be a crazy ending to this psalm. Didn't he begin the psalm describing how everything's changing? Like, you have the unchanging one, but you have us constantly changing. You know, migrant dust balls on the move. And now he's ending saying that what you do can actually be in him established. That when we honestly embrace the fragility of our lives and we see the sovereignty of our God, that leads not to fatalism, but to meaningful labor. Your labor is not in vain in the Lord. And notice it's the work of your hands, the work of our hands. Our words, our works in a passing world actually matter. Finding our dwelling place in the unchangeable love of God does not stifle change. It ironically fuels it. We begin to learn that some things must change. Other things cannot. Gordon McKenzie worked at Hallmark Cards for 30 years. He built it into a $3.6 billion company. He was known for stimulating creativity and an environment of change. And he wrote in his classic book, Orbiting the Giant Hairball, A Corporate Fool's Guide to Surviving with Grace, his philosophy. His goal was to bridge the gap between what he called creative chaos and corporate bureaucracy. And the image of the hairball represented the systems and entangled webs of policies and procedures that most businesses must have. He describes it this way. A hairball, from his perspective, is an entangled pattern of behavior. It's bureaucracy, which doesn't allow much space for original thinking and creativity. It's the corporate tendency to rely on past policies, decisions, and processes as a formula for future success. And he explains that these hairballs provide necessary stability. Without a hairball, creativity just kind of spirals off into space, accomplishing nothing. But, he says, if no one is orbiting outside of the hairball, then nothing changes, and creativity is stifled. He writes this, to be fully free to create, we must first find the courage and willingness to let go. Let go of the strategies that have worked for us in the past. Let go of our biases, the foundation of our illusions. Let go of our grievances, the root source of our victimhood. Let go of our so often denied fear of being found unlovable. Now, I know we would have to unpack some of what he's saying, would agree with some, want to wrestle through other parts. But I do think it's very interesting that a big CEO of a big company, when he's talking about change and stability, places such a big emphasis on, look at that last point, for example, or the second one, second to last. Like, those are hard issues, our grievances that turn us into victims, our so often denied fear of being found unlovable. I mean, what is he saying? He's saying you're never going to really have a healthy relationship with change unless you get to the heart. Now, he doesn't really describe how to get there, but that's what the Bible does. It goes after that. Like, it gets right to the root of, why am I convinced that I'm unlovable? Why do I believe the voices in my head more than I believe the Word of God? How do I change that? A heart stabilized by the steadfast love of God is able to both maintain stability rooted in the unchanging one and soar in creativity, no longer entangled by fear and insecurity. And we want to be that kind of person. Lord, there are some things that are not going to change. You, the unchanging one, your law of love. But there are some things that you've called us to change in this world, in our hearts, in our lives. We want to know the difference. We want to have a healthy relationship with the stability of things that shouldn't change and the creativity of things that should. But like Moses, we have to begin where the action is, in the heart.